Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Seriously Risky Business is the podcast and newsletter we do here at Risky Biz HQ with Tom Uren. Tom Uren writes the newsletter and we do this podcast together. And the idea is we talk about cyber stuff from a more sort of macro and policy point of view. This work is supported by our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint, for Seriously Risky Biz, and also we've had some assistance from the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative, so big thanks to both of them for supporting this work. Tom Uren, welcome. How are you going?
Good, Pat. How are you?
Good, good. So, yeah, we've just finished doing the edit of your newsletter, and you've done some fairly detailed analysis here on all of this Team Jorge stuff, right? So there's been a consortium of media outlets and journalists and investigators who've been looking into some of these companies that peddle sort of internet influence for hire, right? And these things are somewhat difficult to get your hands around, to get your arms around, because depending on who you listen to, either these people are secretly controlling the world's agenda, or they're not really that effective at all. But what you've done is done sort of more of a brass tacks analysis of what it is that they actually claim to do and actually deliver. So why don't you just walk us through where you landed on all of this stuff?
So where did I land? I landed on the position that there's an awful lot of smoke and mirrors in that these companies are really about giving the appearance of having a lot of influence. And so they do some quite sensational sounding things, but it's quite hard to convince myself that they're actually truly effective. Now, despite that, I still think that they're a real problem because what they do is just corrosive for democracy, and it encourages people to believe nothing at all. And I think that makes it hard to govern countries.
And so it doesn't matter if they're delivering bad outcomes. The point is that you're getting at, I think, is that they're trying to deliver bad outcomes, right? And that's, that's all
they're
really
trying
matters.
To. Yeah. They may occasionally actually achieve them. I think they try so much different stuff, and I guess we'll talk about that.
Just to take a step back, I realized I didn't really set this up properly. Really what's happened here is a group of researchers have discovered, a bunch of these companies that sort of Cambridge Analytica plus Hack and Leak, I guess, is kind of the pitch. The idea is, you know, if you want to get your candidate elected in some election in Africa, you give these guys a bundle of money and they're going to manipulate social media discourse. They're going to fuel these manipulations with stolen documents and messages, and you know they're going to engineer scandals and just, you know, internet era political dirty tricks plus social media manipulation plus Hack and Leak is really their pitch.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a whole range of different media outlets that have been involved. Probably the most sensational claims are actually in Israeli media. Haaretz, the newspaper, talks about being in I guess a briefing with the Team Jorge people, and the Team Jorge people muse about causing explosions and bombs and stuff like that. So they never actually claim to offer that as a service, but that's the kind of
we could get people so riled up they're going to commit acts of terrorism. Gee, what a pitch.
Yeah, that's right. So they really go full out. Haaretz describes Tal Hanan, who's the sort of main character in this story, as a first-rate salesman. And I really got the strong impression that they'll do anything to sell what they're trying to do, even at the expense of actually achieving anything. Mm. So one of the stories is that Hanan does a live demonstration of hacking a Telegram account. And he'll say the particular victim was actually the political advisor of a presidential candidate in Kenya. So this demo was run during the election period. He brings up the Telegram account of this advisor, Dennis Itumbo, and he actually even sends a message. He demonstrates that he can get access to the different messages and actually sends one. So that's the kind of really totally cavalier approach to OPSEC, which means you don't actually care if you're discovered. It's all about selling what you've got rather than protecting what you have.
Yeah. I mean, some of the claims, though, and this is the interesting bit that I think, you know, the podcast version of this can add, is kind of some of the stuff that we took out of the newsletter, because some of the claims that they make don't really make sense. Let's start with one that we left in, which is that they say on election day in Nigeria, they claim to have, like, clogged up a political party's phone lines, right? And I'm thinking, how does that help you on election day? How does that help the opponent on election day to run a DOS against the phone lines? Like, there's a lot of this sort of stuff that's included in the write-ups about Team Jorge, where you think, what outcome are you actually going for there? The other one that's just truly weird that we managed to take out is, I think this is from Forbidden Stories. They wrote, you know, Team Jorge talks about how they ordered a bunch of sex toys to the house of a political rival of one of their clients, which somehow caused the rival candidate's wife to believe that he had been unfaithful. Now, he'd used some pretty blonde-haired avatar to do this ordering. So what is it? Like, the package turns up with that person's name on it, and then the wife is supposed to intercept the package and Google the name and find this pretty fake persona. Do you need a mass persona, you know, social media persona manipulation and generation system to do this? You know, like, so this whole box of dildos story is just really strange, and I don't understand what, you know, why you would... It's just there's some very weird dimensions to this, is what I'm getting at.
I mean, the actual quote from Jorge, which is Hanan's pseudonym, is that after that, the story was leaked and he couldn't go home. The campaign turned around. So there's several steps in there. And I wanted to include it because it kind of is illustrative of a story that at first glance goes, you can go, okay, yeah, yeah. And then you think about it a bit more and you go, hang on.
How does
that
work? Is
that actually... What? and that seems to me to be all about marketing rather than results, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I mean. It just seems like a sales pitchy thing that sounds good for the first 30 seconds, and then you're thinking, well, hang on. I mean, I could do that right now. I could, you know, set up some fake...
To me, the really hilarious thing is that it's all part of a 30,000 bot social media network that he claims to have. And that's meant to influence the narratives in different countries. But this story, you don't need a bot network to achieve that. You just need a single account. And who knows if it would even achieve that. So it, to me, highlighted the somewhat ludicrous aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, this sort of illustrates what I said at the intro, right? Which is that this thing is hard to wrap your arms around, because trying to attribute outcomes to various, you know, actions, particularly around politics, is very, very difficult, right? So I think for a lot of these companies, when things go the way of their clients, they can claim that it was them. When things go against them, well, sorry, guys, that's just how the mop flops, right? So I think it's like that a lot with just general digital marketing and digital advertising as well. But, you know, in this case, they really do sell the sizzle of the illicit stuff to try to demonstrate that they have some sort of magical, you know, internet algorithm magic, right?
Yeah, so they claim that they've been involved in 33 different presidential level elections, and 27 of them successfully. The thing is, these are all elections in... like a variety of different continents, Africa, Europe, even Asia. But many of the countries that they refer to or specifically talk about, I would say that governance is not the strong suit of those countries. And there's just so many different influences, many of them I would call corrupting, that go into those elections, that you add one company to the mix doing a few extra dirty tricks. Does that swing an election? I don't think so.
Yeah. Is it decisive? No. Like, does it have an impact? Maybe. It's like when you look at some of these people who might say, you know, design a campaign to stoke racial or ethnic tensions in a particular region. You know, those tensions are usually there to begin with. Like, are you actually pouring fuel on the fire, or is it already set to burn out of control? And that's what I mean about attributing outcomes to some of these actions is quite difficult. Now, I will caveat everything that I've just said by saying that I have heard from someone in the who's familiar with the research work that's gone into this, and they have said that there's a lot more to come on this and some pretty gnarly stuff. So I guess though the question becomes, you know, are these types of companies, because it's not just Team Jorge, there's another one, the name escapes me right now, there's another one that's been sort of unveiled recently, are these sorts of firms, these hacker for hire firms, we saw the India ones, right, which were mostly being used by private investigators, you know, would contract hacking services to these India hacker for hire companies like Beltrox and whatever, to gather intelligence, corporate intelligence, mostly legal intelligence, stuff like that. Now we see, you know, some of these hacking services being offered as part of political dirty tricks campaigns. The question is, you know, is this category the new boogeyman? Right? Is it the new internet villain? Move over NSO Group, you know, move over Kandaroo, exploit developers. It feels like policymakers have got a real solid handle on what those companies are these days, how they can be regulated. Everything's moving in the right direction there. And now we've got this new group of this new type of company emerging. Do you think this is the next one where policymakers and regulators really need to have a good think about what to do about them?
Yes. So as you were talking, I was going to argue with the description of boogeyman in the sense that a boogeyman to me is something that's a fictitious fear. And so I would say that these companies are doing a whole lot of bad stuff. Some of that stuff might work, but just because a lot of it doesn't mean that we shouldn't worry about them and do something about them.
Well, I mean, the word that you used that I keep coming back to in my head is corrosive.
Yeah, exactly. So even if they don't match their marketing, I still think they're doing bad stuff that is just bad. They should be
They're doing bad
stopped.
Stuff that is just bad. This is
exactly, yeah.
This is five-star commentary here at risky.biz.
that's why you tune into this sort of insightful analysis. it's bad, Patrick, it's bad. And I think it just undermines people's belief in anything. So in one of the elections, for example, and again, this is probably nothing at all to do with Team Jorge, but there's immediately a complaint about the legitimacy of the election, right? And this dynamic where there's a lot of companies and trying to get involved in this space just undermines people's belief in everything.
Mm. No, I'm with you. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, I guess the reason I'm primed to be extremely skeptical about their claims is because it's my belief that Cambridge Analytica was selling something that they couldn't deliver, right?
Yeah, so Cambridge Analytica was actually involved with this company as well. Yeah. And ironically, at some point in some of the emails, Cambridge Analytica is skeptical about what this company can deliver.
Yeah.
So it's skepticism all the way down.
It takes a grifter to no one, right? And that's the thing. I mean, I just feel like in this area, I'm sure they're all doing really horrible things. They might be chalking up successes every now and then, but they really do try to make themselves a lot more scary and a lot more capable than they actually are. In some ways, Tom, it actually reminds me of some of the leaked PowerPoint slide decks that came out of NSA, which made some of these like rather boring programs sound extremely scary and all-encompassing, right? Like, don't get me wrong, there was some impressive stuff that came out of the Snowden leaks. But, you know, everyone had to sex up their slide decks. It seems like it was a rule at NSA that when you were presenting to your superiors, you had to make it sound like you had total information dominance and, you know, like just well, really make it sound sexy.
Yeah, that's so funny. There is a real dynamic there of trying to demonstrate impact. And I guess that's exactly the same thing that's going on here.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because you're overselling stuff doesn't mean that it's not, you know, there's something that's not
it's
worth
not
doing
useful,
about.
Yeah. Anyway, look, I'm sure we're going to see more detail on that as time marches on. But I did find your analysis of that very, very interesting. So people can go to risky.biz/subscribe and get the link to Tom's newsletter there. And, you know, we've got a couple other things to talk about this week. I mean, Adam and I yesterday, we did speak about the Google Mandiant report. I think it was Tag, Mandiant, and also the user protection group at Google all worked together on a report into Russia's cyber activity in Ukraine. And I think, you know, you summed it up where you said they got a... let me just read from your newsletter. The overall vibe of the report is that Russian government cyber actors get an A for effort and a C for results. And you're right. I mean, that is the vibe of the report. There's a couple of weird things in it that we spoke about on yesterday's show where they sort of imply Russian operators were able to cyber disable the Bayraktar TB2 drones, and they don't provide any evidence. And it's very strange claim. But you know, they've added some good stuff to the public corpus of information on this stuff. It's just a shame that you have to read these reports so skeptically to get any value from them.
I find these reports really valuable because they put on the public record something that's a bit of a mystery. And the two companies I'm most thinking of are Microsoft and Google. But this week there were actually several people who released reports, it being about a year after the invasion. And what's interesting to me is that they're kind of basically all saying more or less the same thing. But these are also marketing documents. So as well, you have to sort of be careful that you have to make sure that what you're reading doesn't reflect the marketing rather than the truth.
That's kind of what I was getting at about having to read them with a skeptical eye, right?
Yeah,
like there's absolutely valuable information in them, but there's a couple of points where you read them and you're just like, that does not belong in this report. You know, this is a very, you know, and it's particularly the timeline around the Sandworm crew where they just made some really odd claims that they don't substantiate, you know. And you just think, God, why did you put that in there? You know, it's a real fly in the ointment.
Yeah, I thought that claim should either be in there and backed up or not, it shouldn't be in there at all. Yeah. I think I listened to the show, Adam's view, which I 100% agreed with, is that if this happened, this is a sensational thing that deserves a lot of, examination, commentary. It deserves a lot of media. If it's not true, don't put it in there at all. And it's kind of this in-between space where they imply it, but if you actually really parse what they're saying, it doesn't mean anything at all. It was just disappointing.
Well, they're clearly implying something there. And any reasonable person would take the same inference. Anyway, we're sort of getting bogged down in this, but I think the point is that it's a shame that companies like Microsoft and now Google aren't really serious and sober when doing this stuff, right? Like, you have to be careful with this stuff if you want to have credibility. Then again, we're probably not the target audience, so.
I really don't understand the dynamic. I think it's short-sighted and it's a mistake.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny, actually, because, you know, you and I have been two of the people in the public sphere certainly saying that Russia's results have been pretty disappointing. And, you know, this is for Russia, not for us, obviously. We don't want to see them succeeding. But this has actually caused us, like, we have been on the receiving end of a bit of flack over this, because there are some people who have made, overstating Russia's cyber capabilities, they've made it their entire personality, right? And when they read stuff that you put out saying, well, doesn't really look like they've been tremendously successful, they get quite upset and they, you know, they subtweet us and, you know, send messages and things. I just want to read too. This just crossed my desk this morning. Wiley Newmark sent a Mastodon toot this morning, which I just think is worth repeating here. I'll just read it. It says, dare I say, the biggest value that GRU cyber operators are demonstrating to their higher-ups by spamming wipers at Ukrainian targets, with comparatively little in the way of substantive first-order impacts inflicted, is the second-order effect of a bunch of cyberarty big brains shrieking, cyber war, none of you understand the cyber war, up and down the security community. This wastes everyone's time, including actual defenders and operators who are trying to contain and respond to live threats, but also likely feeds into inflated threat perceptions held by Western audiences and potentially even policymakers. Those perceptions can be exploited in myriad ways, including reflexive control. Looking at a threat soberly, holistically, and objectively, then acknowledging it as meaningful but not epochal, does not, in fact, make one irresponsible. And I just read that this morning. I think the first thing I did was copied a link and pasted it to you. And all I have to say about that is amen. I think that's a really nice summary that you and I would agree with.
Yep. So I would not say that cyber operations in war are something that we should ignore or diminish.
No,
I think
they're
a real thing, right?
But and you I haven't think said that. And a couple of people have tried to verbal you and sort of suggest that's what you're saying, but it's not.
Yeah. And I think the what's happened in Ukraine is really interesting in the sense that it allows us to see one way of doing things and to try and make our own judgments about whether that's the best way or whether we should be doing something else. I mean, the questions I still have are, is it even possible for a military to do really effective cyber operations in an ongoing war regularly? The Russians did something really effective, or could have been really effective if it had been taken advantage of right at the beginning of the war. And then I'm not really aware of any evidence that they've done anything like that ever since.
Yeah.
Now, is that just the nature of war? Like, conventional war moves faster than your cyber operations can sort of prepare, plan.
Well, that's an inversion of the expectation, isn't it? That conventional operations moving faster than cyber, you would have thought, you know, intuitively that it'd be the other way around.
Well, I think it depends how you look at it, right? If you've got something lined up, you can execute it in an instant, right? But if it's not lined up, then it seems like it's weeks to months of planning. And so maybe it can just never happen. We just can't keep up in our... That, to me, has implications for how you spend money, right?
Mm.
And what you spend money on, how much you think you should get out of it, and how much you should invest in other things. And so, to me, all those questions are actually still unresolved in that I don't know, and these reports don't tell us, how much the Russians actually tried to really closely get cyber operations to sort of magnify or amplify or be synergistic with conventional military forces. If they didn't try, it doesn't tell us anything. If they tried but couldn't do it, I think that's significant.
Yeah. Now, the last thing that you wrote up for your newsletter was actually a write-up of the interview that I did with Andrew Boyd, who is the director of the Center for Cyber Intelligence at CIA. And, you know, this is it's a big deal interview. As far as I know, this is the first time someone from CIA has actually sat down with a journalist to talk about cyber stuff. So, you know, big deal in that sense.
Yep, congratulations.
Thank you very much. that's about an hour-long podcast, and we've posted it into the main feed this morning. I think it was, and I know you will find this, it was very satisfying, actually, in the interview, where Boyd actually said that CCI comes down on the same side of this analysis war as we do, right? Which is that Russia's efforts have not been tremendously scary on the cyber front. But what's really interesting is that then turns into a conversation with Boyd about why a West against China cyber conflict would be extremely different. So to me, that was the really, really interesting part of the interview.
I thought that was interesting. So the Gruck and I have talked several times about Russia and the West, the US, how they use cyber operations differently. And in both cases, there are real world examples. So the US has talked about some. We see in the Ukraine war, what's happened with Russia. For the Chinese, we've not talked about it because there's no real-world examples. So all we've got is the sort of conception that's from what's written in their doctrine. So what I think is really interesting about what Boyd says is sort of his view on how they just approach cyber operations tremendously differently.
Yeah.
And so it's an...
He also said that it's his view that they're collecting access at the moment into computer systems in the United States in case they want to use that access during a cyber conflict. So, you know, he says they're already doing some sort of, you know, what do they call it? Operational preparation, right? Yeah. So I found that was a pretty, you know, that's a pretty amazing claim to have on record from the CIA.
Yeah, no, he did say, and his caveat was that without any concrete evidence, but I thought it was really quite sensational that you have an intelligence professional say that publicly. And, you know, the secrecy culture here is just so terrible. It's kind of it's just sort of unfathomable to me, for me to think of an Australian intelligence person saying that to the media.
When I sent this interview, around the team just to get some feedback before I published it. The funniest bit of feedback I got was from our colleague, Catalin Kimpanu, who emailed me a reply which said, "It's fine, Global Times is going to have a blast with this one." But as long as they link back, am I right? All right, Tom Uren, that is it for this week's edition of the Seriously Risky Business Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me for this discussion. It was very interesting, as always, and we'll do it again next week.
Great. Thanks, Pat.